We continued in silence along the winding deer trails until we reached a plateau where the sage stopped abruptly. She handed me another stone and pointed toward a tree trunk about 20 feet away. "I have a challenge for you," she announced.
"Another tree?" I asked.
"Yes, but this time you have only one stone, one chance to hit the tree square on."
"And if I don't?"
"I have more treasures to share, but if you miss the tree, our time together is over," she said.
"You really mean that?"
"I mean everything I say."
"Why is it so important that I hit the tree in one try?" I asked, pointing toward it.
"Not that tree," she corrected me. "The other one, over there." She pointed to a large oak 90 feet away.
"I can't possibly hit that in one try. What about the law of process? Shouldn't I start closer?"
"This is not about the law of process. This is about the law of expectation, about how your underlying beliefs and assumptions shape your experience."
"Well, I admit it then. I don't believe I can hit that tree."
"I believe you will," she said, smiling.
"If you believe it, then you hit it," I replied.
Ignoring my comment, the sage sat down and invited me to do the same, but I declined. "I'd rather stand if you don't mind. I'm a little tense."
"Stay present," she reminded me. "You'll always have time to worry later on, if you want to."
So I sat and listened. "Before anything manifests in this world," she began, "it first appears as a thought or image in someone's mind. Your thoughts color the windows through which you see the world. Your beliefs become the building blocks of experience. In other words, every positive thought is a prayer, and every prayer is answered."
"Do you really believe that?" I asked.
"What I believe is less important right now than what you believe," she replied.
"Not what you think you believe. Such surface beliefs have little impact. Only your deepest underlying assumptions and expectations have the power to shape your reality."
"That reminds me of an old poem," I said. "Two men looked through prison bars. One saw mud, the other saw stars."
"Yes," she said. "What you see depends on where you choose to look, and where you look depends upon what you expect to see. If you believe, for example, that people can't be trusted, you'll see the world through the filter of this expectation and find evidence that supports it. Your beliefs influence the choices you make, the directions you take, even the friends, adversaries, and destiny you meet. Your beliefs set into motion inner processes and behaviors that influence how you move, act, and feel. On more subtle levels, your thoughts even affect the size and color of your energy field to which other people respond. If, for example, you perceive people around you as friends who like you, you feel relaxed and expansive. Your energy and behaviors draw them to you. This is one way your expectations shape your reality."
"Well, that all makes sense, and I can't wait to learn how this is going to help me hit the tree on my first try."
"Your only try," she corrected, gesturing for me to stand.
"Now, focus all your attention on the tree. Get ready to throw the stone and say aloud, 'I can hit the tree with ease.'"
Feeling silly, I said, "Okay, I can hit the tree with ease."
I didn't believe it for a second, of course. In fact, I was overcome by doubts. There was no way I could hit the tree at 90 feet, the first try or probably any try. Not if I threw left, then right. Not if I started up close, which she wouldn't let me do anyway. Not if I were a major league pitcher. No one could be expected to do this. It was just too far.
"Hitting the tree is easy," said the sage, responding once again to my thoughts. "The challenge is overcoming the negative beliefs that hold you back."
She picked up a stone. My mouth dropped open as she flung the stone into space, hitting the tree dead center with a resounding whack.
"That was just to get your attention," she said, smiling, while I stared wide-eyed.
"It isn't enough for you to repeat over and over, 'I can do it, I can do it,'" she explained. "Not while your underlying doubts are stealing your spirit, robbing you of your focus and strength. I want you to bring these negative expectations into the open, into the light of conscious awareness, where they can be seen for what they are. Go ahead, shout them out at the top of your lungs." I felt really stupid, but I did as she asked. I yelled out all the reasons I couldn't hit the tree. I voiced all my doubts at her urging again and again out loud.
Now, she said, look at the tree again and create this expectation. I can hit the tree with ease. So I said it again. I can hit the tree with ease. And the strangest thing happened. Not a single doubt came up. It was simply true. I felt it. I believed it. Completely. It rang true and real. As I looked at that tree, I felt a line of energy stretching from me to that trunk, and I knew the stone would follow that line to its target. I stood squarely, on balance. Nothing else existed but me and that stone and that tree. For an instant, there was no me left. That's when I took a breath and threw the stone. The moment I let it go, I knew it would hit its target. I saw it fly, attracted to the tree like a magnet. The stone hit the trunk dead center, and as it hit, something shifted inside of me. I understood the law of expectation. Before I could do it, I had to believe it. I had to really expect it. Nodding, the sage said, before you did it, you saw it happen in your mind. And in your daily life, if you create positive images, happy circumstances, and successful outcomes, these become real to your deeper mind, which builds upon such experiences to attract similar ones. The law of expectation reminds you of your inherent power to shape your life through the images and expectations you create. By airing all your doubts, you root them up from the deeper mind so that they can dissolve in the light of awareness. What if I created the expectation that I could fly? Could I use the same process? I don't want to dampen your enthusiasm, traveler, but the laws of spirit that manifest in this plane of reality are senior to our human beliefs. You see, gravity works whether you believe in it or not. So even if I banished all doubts, I still couldn't fly. But you can fly, she said. You can soar into the air, fly into space, and land on the moon. Enormous doubts, even scientific belief, had to be overcome before humanity could do the impossible and take flight. Within the laws of spirit, there are no limits except our beliefs. Our future as individuals and as a species will mirror our ability to understand and apply the law of expectation. As we hiked down into the valley, the sage continued, the law of expectation highlights the importance of examining your old beliefs and assumptions, replacing self-defeating doubts with vivid imagery, and creating new beliefs based on clear intention. Well, what if there's no evidence to support that belief? I asked. That is just what I have tried to express to you, she said. Believe it anyway. The expectation will attract the evidence. I'll do my best, I replied, but speaking of self-defeating doubts, reading the newspaper sometimes depresses me. It's easy to lose hope for humanity, with all our environmental problems, unwanted children, crime, and greed. I'm not filled with hope, said the sage. I'm filled with faith. Real problems exist, but even as we address the issues that cry out for help, it seems wisest to focus on positive outcomes and on our human potential. The law of expectation teaches that what we focus on expands. Fighting problems only strengthens them by giving them energy. So focus on the solutions, not on the problems. The sage glanced up at a hawk above our upturned heads, floating like a kite on the wind, and shared a final reminder about the law of expectation. Like the ancient alchemists, traveler, you can transmute doubt into confidence and fear into courage. New expectations breed new choices. Don't wait for experiences to confirm them. Create a new vision of who you would become, and you surely will become it. After watching the hawk spiral upward on rising currents of air, we headed into a deep valley where the trees wore a lace of emerald moss. As we descended, I thought about the laws I had learned so far, but could recall few details. Addressing my concerns, the sage said, you don't have to remember all the words, traveler. Words are only sounds. Yet, some voices carry the power to penetrate the heart and touch the soul. You acquire this spiritual authority only by living the laws of spirit. Stopping, she gazed into the distance and pointed to a peak behind us. Can you see the summit of that hill?
You don't want me to hit it with a rock, do you? She smiled. No, nothing like that. I just want you to climb to the top and return here within 30 minutes. I gazed up at the hilltop. 30 minutes? But even if I ran all the way there and back, I still doubt... I mean, I suppose I could work with my beliefs. You have 29 minutes left, she said. I shut up and took off. The run was difficult and painful. Halfway up, my lungs burned so badly that I considered turning back before I reached the top. I felt I couldn't go on, but I had to, so I did. I hit my wall and went through it. When I returned, I nearly fell at her feet. I was 10 minutes late. I was breathing hard and wondering what this failure meant when the sage asked, "Why didn't you turn around before you reached the top? That way you could have gotten back on time. Who would have known the difference?" "I would," I said, catching my breath. "I would have known." She smiled broadly. "There you have it. The law of integrity is about living in line with your highest vision, despite impulses to the contrary, about how you behave when no one is watching." The sage led me, still soaking with perspiration, over a rise where we came to a seasonal pond, still full from winter rains. Without a trace of self-consciousness, she removed her outer clothing and entered the pond. I did the same. It was not my everyday experience to be alone in the mountains, nearly skinny-dipping, with a woman other than my wife. The sage was attractive enough. I found myself wondering if she had a love life. I felt a twinge of guilt. Not that I had any sexual intentions. I did have my rules. But I can't say the thought didn't cross my mind. Just then she turned around and spoke to my thoughts. "Breaking society's codes is like swimming upstream against the current of contemporary values. It can be done if your heart's deepest desire will not be denied. But it makes life more difficult, even exhausting, and it has consequences."
"Such as?"
"Such as ruffling the beliefs and emotions of others who take those beliefs very seriously," she said.
"So integrity means following social conventions?"
"Following the conventions of your society and avoiding what is considered unethical, illegal, or immoral is not about integrity. It's about intelligence."
"So you recommend conformity because it's easier?"
"I'm not recommending that you blindly conform or blindly rebel. Just keep your eyes open and pay more attention to your heart's highest wisdom than to indulging or denying random impulses or desires. Follow Martin Luther's guidance on integrity. Love God and do as you please." "Do as you please," I thought, wondering for a moment whether this were some kind of invitation and what I would do if it were. My ruminations were soon interrupted by the sage's words as she slipped back into her clothes and indicated that I should do the same. "As I was saying, traveler, the law of integrity calls forth a genuine expression of our internal reality. It also recognizes that if envy, greed, or manipulation influence our actions or expression, the consequences are inevitable, built into the mechanics of the universe. In breaking spiritual law, the act itself is the punishment, setting into motion subtle forces whose consequences we cannot escape any more than we can escape the law of gravity." By this time we had walked deeper into the valley, where steep hillsides and thick foliage muffled the sounds of our passing. Lost in thought about conventions, desires, and integrity, I nearly collided with the sage, who had stopped to point at a lizard peeking out of a rock crevice.
"That lizard is not trying to be something else," she said. Then she began pointing toward one object after another, saying, "That is a tree. There is a brook."
"Yes," I interrupted, "I see them."
"But can you feel them?"
"I'm not sure what you mean." "Unlike the creatures of the natural world, humans are surrounded by social artifice, cut off from their own true natures." Then, speaking almost in a whisper, she said, "The shamans, the healers of the native peoples, practice the art of shape-shifting. This art is not as much about changing your body as expanding your awareness into an animal, a tree, or a stream in order to feel them, to learn their lessons, identifying with each one so that you can feel its inner qualities and become it. This is possible because your larger self contains all these things."
"What does this have to do with the law of integrity?" I asked. I thought you might ask, she said, smiling. My friend Lao Tzu once said, the snow goose need not bathe itself to make itself white, nor must you do anything but be yourself. The natural world is ripe with such authenticity. The rushing stream, the moving wind, and the chirping crickets are content to be themselves. Are you content to be who you are completely, to be nothing more, nothing less? What if I want to become something more, I asked. More, the sage smiled. How could you be more? You are already limitless, boundless. When you die, traveler, no one at the gates of heaven will ask if you were a saint. They will ask if you were yourself. The wisdom of the ages, she continued, from Plato to Shakespeare reminds us, know thyself, and to thine own self be true. Integrity means being integrated, knowing ourselves and being ourselves, so that our actions are authentic, consistent with our highest intentions, so that our body, mind, emotions, and attitudes complement one another, forming a whole that is greater than the sum of the parts. It's meaningless to speak of integrity until we understand our innermost drives, values, and motives, until we accept who we are rather than who we hope or pretend to be. One person may give to the poor out of love and compassion. Another may give out of guilt or the need to impress others. Each shows charity. Only one shows integrity. Motives and intent make a vast difference in the lives of both givers and recipients, because we give far more than coins. We give the currency of the self. I'm getting the impression that integrity is a lot more difficult to achieve than I thought. Everything is difficult until it becomes easy, the sage replied. It takes courage and openness to achieve authenticity, to be able to say to yourself and to the world, like it or not, this is who I am, and then to live that truth. But once you accept your humanity, integrity is not difficult at all. It's not about being perfect or infallible. We've all made mistakes. We can only do our best and learn from our mistakes so that we can do better next time. Alignment with the law of integrity means acknowledging our weaknesses and drawing on our inner strengths, so we become examples who light the way for others. Maybe that's what Mahatma Gandhi meant when he said, "My life is my teaching." Yes, she responded. Children have never been very good at listening to their parents, but they never fail to imitate them. I don't think you're just talking about children. Indeed not, the sage replied. We all influence one another by our example, and we all learn by imitation, whether or not we are conscious of it. We touch others not so much by what we say, but by how we live. I once walked down an isolated stretch of road with a woman who called herself Peace Pilgrim, the sage continued. She traveled on faith, walking until offered shelter and fasting until given food, reminding us, live according to your highest light and more light will be given. This summarizes the essence of integrity, and this is what you are called upon to practice. Emerging from the valley, we climbed a short, steep incline and ended up on a rise just above the sage's hut. My stomach growled. Except for a handful of berries, I hadn't eaten in nearly 2 days. Just then, the sage announced, "It's time we ate." "Funny," I said. "I was just thinking about that." "I know," she said. "I could hear your stomach rumbling." Smiling, she led me to a garden she had cultivated. A brook flowed through it, which she had used to irrigate the colorful herbs, fruits, and vegetables growing there. "Pick whatever appeals to you," she said. We cooked squash and potatoes, spiced with bittersweet parsley and some other herbs I didn't recognize, served with a fresh salad. As we sat down to eat, the sage spoke of the law of action. "You can't eat good intentions," she began. "To prepare this meal, I cleared the land, dug the soil, and sowed the seeds before reaping the harvest. It takes more than dreams and good intentions to live in this world. It takes action." As we ate, she told me of an incident, from a former life, I supposed. "I didn't always appreciate the difference between ideas and action," said the sage. "As a young scholar in India, I learned a valuable lesson. At that time, I came from a privileged family, spending most of my time reading. One day, while on a journey, as the boatman took me across a wide river. I described to him how I had gathered all my knowledge. The boatman listened attentively. Then, after a time, he asked me if I could swim. "No," I replied, "I cannot." "Then I'm afraid your knowledge is wasted," said the boatman. "This boat is sinking." We both laughed as her point struck home. "Well, what happened?" I asked her. "Oh, I drowned," she answered. "It was a lesson I would never forget." This world is a realm of energy and action. No matter what you know or who you are, no matter how many books you have read or what your talents, only action brings potential to life. Philosophies impress and ideas abound, but words, no matter how elegant, are cheap. It's easy to speak about commitment, courage, and love, but doing is understanding, and wisdom grows out of practice. I followed her then as she walked to the far edge of the garden, climbed some boulders, and surveyed the expanse of forest below. "Many people would wish to enjoy such a view," said the sage. "They might aspire to make the climb and might desire the satisfaction of standing here. But they didn't reach the top or enjoy the view as we are, not because we are smarter or stronger or more deserving, but because we made the climb. Only those who make the climb get to enjoy the summit." Later, as we returned to our meal, the sage observed, "Taking action has never been easy in this world. Forces of doubt and inertia are everywhere, even within our mind and body. Turning ideas into action requires energy, sacrifice, courage, and heart, because to act is to risk. We have to overcome all the good reasons to put it off, to let someone else do it, to remain in the easy chair of good intentions. But the law of action delivers the same message again and again. It's better to do what is best than not to do it and have a good excuse." "It seems to me that just getting out of bed in the morning takes courage," I said, "so everybody applies the law of action." "All living beings act, but most people react, and then only when compelled by pain or fear, when relationships break into warfare, or when bodies become ill from stress. The law of action teaches us to overcome both inertia and impatience by acting out of courage, clear intention, and commitment." "So how does one overcome inertia?" "By acknowledging three fundamental realities," she replied. "First, by accepting our humanity and our physical presence in the world. Second, by realizing that no one is going to live for us, and that we only grow stronger from our own efforts. And third, by accepting that action may entail discomfort, and then getting on with it." We no longer have the luxury of waiting until we feel safe and secure, inspired or motivated, until fear or doubt is looking the other way. We can no longer wait for someone to give us permission to act. "I feel a great urgency," she said. "That's why I've appeared again in this time and place, why I'm speaking to you now. The time has come to act in line with our highest ideals, despite fears, doubts, or uncertainties that arise. We can only show courage in the face of fear. Every day we need courage, because every day we face fears. Not necessarily in dramatic ways like tackling a bank robber or saving a drowning person, but in expressing our feelings, breaking an old habit, or taking the risk to be different." We stood and began to clean up what little remained of our meal. Then she led me through some trees to the edge of a hillside so steep it almost qualified as a cliff. "I like to scatter the scraps as an offering to the animals, but not too near the hut," she said. Standing at the edge of the precipice, the sage began throwing a few scraps down for the deer grazing far below. Suddenly, the hillside on which she stood, soft from heavy rains, gave way. Before my shocked eyes, she disappeared from sight. I lunged forward and saw her tumbling down. I found myself leaping over the edge, trying to maintain my balance as I slid after her. We were now both sliding toward a vertical drop-off. She must have been conscious because I saw her grabbing at tree roots, trying to slow herself down. It all happened as if in slow motion, in crisp detail. I knew I was getting bruised and scraped, but I felt no pain. I wanted to help her if I could, but first I had to help myself. I began grabbing at roots and grasses. Luck was with me, and as I fell past her, we clasped hands. That must have been when the falling stone glanced off my head, because I remembered nothing more. I woke up lying next to a pond. My head was wet with blood. I opened my eyes and saw the sage, her face dirty but smiling, as she wiped my head with a wet cloth. "The bleeding stopped," she said. "It looks like you're going to live."
"You too," I said, managing to return her smile.
Later, in the chill of evening, as we huddled by the fire back in her hut, I reflected upon what had happened, and fear finally hit me. We could have been killed. Or I could have been killed. I don't know about you.
"You would have been a little wiser and a lot safer if you had stayed where you were," she responded. "But you showed courage in coming after me."
"I wasn't being courageous. I didn't think about it. I just saw you fall and I jumped."
"Still, a perfect demonstration of the law of action."
"Well, if you need any future demonstrations, I'd prefer throwing rocks at trees," I said.
She smiled. "Sometimes these things happen."
"Well, it must have been your year for falling down hills," I said, referring to the earlier fall she had told me about.
"Do you think it's a sign for me to live closer to sea level?" she asked.
Then, more serious, she added, "It could have gone the other way. You might have gotten yourself killed. Your impulse to help was both commendable and short-sighted."
"What?"
"You assumed that I couldn't help myself."
"Well, you did look like you needed a little help."
"And so I did. Still, be aware that every law contains the seeds of its opposite. Sometimes compassion demands action, but this law also teaches the wisdom of remaining still and quiet, the action of non-action."
"Like meditation," I said.
"Yes. There is a time for action and a time for stillness. You can sometimes show the greatest courage, patience, and wisdom by remaining still, even when compelling desires or impulses urge you to act."
"How can one know when to act and when to be still?"
"Those who tend toward inertia or fear need to focus on the will to act bravely and decisively. Those given to impulsive speech or action are wise to stop, take a few breaths, and observe their impulses without feeling compelled to act on them. In any case, listen to the wisdom of your heart. Then you'll know when to remain still and when to seize the moment." After that, we sat together in the stillness of the evening, staring into the flames as the fire's warmth drew out the soreness of our recent adventure. As the evening grew dark, weariness pulled me toward sleep. I lay on my side, gazing into the flames and listening to her voice. "Fire transforms matter into energy, reminding us that all things pass and change. In the end, we are each consumed by the flameless fires of life. So act bravely, traveler, while you still have the time, while you still have a body." That night in the hut, I had a vivid dream. At least I think it was a dream. I was awakened by the sage's voice. It was already light outside, even though it seemed I had just fallen asleep. I felt no soreness from my earlier fall. In fact, I hardly felt my body at all. The sage said, "Come." I don't remember her lips moving. Then I was standing by the door of the hut, staring out at a bright summer's day. The California grass had turned brown, and the air was dry and dusty. "Close your eyes," she said. I remember a few moments of total darkness and silence. Then my eyes opened to a cloudy autumn day. An early rain must have fallen, for the dust had settled and the dry grass showed traces of green. A cool wind gusted in my face, so I shut my eyes. When I opened them, I felt the crisp chill of winter. The trees that weren't evergreen were bare. Traces of frost lay across fallen leaves. I stepped outside, felt the hard, cold earth, and heard thunder in the distance. In a flash of light, the air changed to spring once again, and I heard the sage's voice. "The natural world dances to the music of change, the passing of the seasons, the revolutions of the heavens, and day turning to night. All things happen in their own good time, changing and growing, appearing and disappearing, waxing and waning, the ebb and flow. Whatever rises will fall, and whatever falls shall rise again. This is the law of cycles." Then it was morning. I awoke refreshed but decidedly sore. After I splashed cold water on my face and ate a few berries, the sage invited me to walk with her to a special place higher in the hills. As we hiked up a rocky trail, I told her about the dream. "The seasons have much to teach you, and your dream is a sign that you're ready to understand." Understand what? That the winds of change may come as a fierce hurricane ripping your life asunder, or as a tender breeze that caresses your cheeks. That change is the only constant, and that it happens in its own way, in its own time. I've always had mixed feelings about change, I said. Sometimes, when life feels dull, I wish for it. But when things are going well, difficult change can feel, well, difficult. Change itself isn't difficult, replied the sage. It happens as naturally as a sunrise. But most of us seek familiar routines to create a sense of control and order. So change can feel like a blessing or a curse, depending on our desires. The same rain welcomed by the flowers is mourned by picnickers wishing for a sunny day. The law of cycles reminds us that as the seasons change, so must we. That our old habits don't have to run our lives, that our past doesn't have to become our future, and that the momentum of change ultimately leads us toward greater awareness, wisdom, and peace. Looking back toward her lush garden, the sage added, "Gardening through the four seasons reveals other lessons of the natural world. That seeds only reproduce their own kind, that you reap only what you sow, that when you gather the harvest you need to save some seed for the next planting, that you have to end one cycle in order to begin another, that there is a time for all seeds to grow, change, and eventually die, to be plowed under for a fresh planting. As with seeds and cycles, so go our lives. Enjoy each season of your life, traveler. Patiently prepare the soil, sow the seeds, and do the work, and you'll harvest the abundant fruits of your labors. Accept both good fortune and adversity as you accept the shifting seasons. Enjoy the glazed beauty of a winter's day and the sultry days of summer, for soon enough, each season, each day, each moment, passes into history, and its exact likeness shall not be seen again. So rather than longing for summer in the midst of winter's chill or wishing for cool winds in the dog days of summer, embrace each season for its own gifts. Align yourself with the cycles of time and transformation, riding change as ships ride the waves. You're saying that cycles of change are going to happen whether I like it or not, so I might as well accept them, right? That and more, she replied. The law of cycles also reveals how to cooperate fully in your own evolution, master good timing, and find good fortune. How so? All things have a most favorable and least favorable time, she answered. Doors open and close. Energies rise and fall. A thought or action initiated while energy is rising and gaining momentum travels along easily toward completion. But a thought or action initiated in a descending cycle has a reduced impact. That's when the law of cycles blends with the law of action, to reveal that patience is the better part of wisdom, wisdom to know when to act and when to keep still, when to talk and when to be silent, when to work and when to rest, when to ride the energy of a building cycle or go within and wait for the next rising wave. As we stepped off the trail and headed directly into a thick growth of trees and brush, the sage paused for a moment and told me a story. In the ancient days, King Solomon felt great inner turmoil and craved the return of simpler, more peaceful times. So he decreed that a master jeweler should make him a magical ring inscribed with words that would be true and appropriate at all times and under all conditions. Words that would help to alleviate suffering and provide the bearer with great wisdom and perspective. The master jeweler crafted a special ring, but only after many days of contemplation did he divine the words of power. Finally, the jeweler presented the ring to Solomon. On it were inscribed the words, "And this too shall pass." The terrain changed abruptly as we stepped out of the trees and came to a sunny clearing. I saw an orange tree, heavy with bright oranges, that I could smell from where I stood, and several apple trees, blossoming but not yet ready to bear fruit, and two other trees I didn't recognize. "They're walnut trees," said the sage, responding to my inner question, her timing perfect, as usual. Then, bowing respectfully to one of the walnut trees, she pulled a small green fruit from one of the branches and handed it to me. "Open it," she said.
I don't think it's ready to eat yet.
Open it, she repeated.
I tried, first with my fingers, then by hitting the green husk between two stones. Finally, I found a sharp stone and tried to chop it open, but with no success. When the sage tapped me on the shoulder, I turned to see she had a handful of ripe walnut shells. From last year's harvest, she said, I had them stored nearby. She took a small stone and gave the shell a light tap, and it popped right open. She did the same with more walnuts, and we enjoyed a filling snack. As we nibbled, she explained, I am here to share with you simple truths for making life work better. But I cannot promise you enlightenment. That has its own timing. We humans, you see, are like the walnut shell. If you try to force it open at the wrong time, it's nearly impossible. But once it's ripe, you just tap at the right place, and it opens easily. Daily life is your ripening process, and one day someone or something will come along and provide the tap. We sat beneath the shade of the apple trees, eating walnuts and oranges as the sun rose toward the treetops. I leaned back against the apple tree and listened to the sounds of the nearby brook, feeling a kinship with the natural world. The sunshine warmed my bones, soothing me into a restful state of deep calm. I lay back, looked up through the shimmering leaves, and watched the clouds drift overhead. As if on cue, the sage said, Notice how the clouds move easily with the wind without haste or resistance. This was an idea I had considered before, but her gentle voice, articulating my innermost thoughts, touched something deep inside me, so that the clouds and the wind penetrated to the center of my awareness. In that moment, nature had become my teacher. The sage finished her instruction about the law of cycles with a story. Many years ago, while traveling in Poland, I visited the humble abode of a renowned rabbi known for his great wisdom. The single room in which he lived was filled with books. Other than that, he had nothing except a single table and a bench. Rabbi, I asked, where is your furniture? Where is yours? He then asked me. Mine, I responded, puzzled. But I'm just passing through. So am I, said the rabbi. So am I. Morning turned to afternoon. A sudden gust of wind rippled the branches over our heads, shaking loose a single leaf that twirled down to land in a nearby brook. Gesturing toward the rushing water, the sage asked, Have you noticed, traveler, how flowing water is soft yet powerful? Yielding, forceful, flexible, it surrenders to gravity without resistance, adapting to the shape of any container. Water reveals the most intelligent and powerful response you can make in any circumstance.
And what response is that?
Surrender, she said.
I don't understand, I said. I was taught to fight for what I believed in, to never give up.
Although the law of surrender means accepting whatever happens in your life, it does not mean passive toleration for what you don't like, or ignoring injustice, or allowing yourself to be victimized or controlled. True surrender is active, positive, assertive, a creative commitment to make use of your situation in a spirit of appreciation.
I can't pretend to appreciate the flu or flat tires or other problems, I responded.
This law is not about pretending anything or denying your true feelings. It's about transforming them. You learn to surrender by shifting your perspective. The sage paced for a few moments, as if searching for the right words. Look at it this way. If you were training in athletics, your coach might give you an award one day and demand a grueling workout the next. You could accept, even appreciate, all of this as part of your training. Well, the same is true in daily life. Spirit is your coach, traveler, and life is your training. So I ask you, what if you could see a flat tire or the flu as an essential part of your learning and growth?
Well, I might as well view it that way, but I never pictured myself surrendering to a flat tire, I joked.
Smiling, the sage explained, In its truest sense, this law guides you to surrender to the moment, to accept whatever arises, including your response to whatever arises. It means accepting not only life's ups and downs, but also accepting yourself, your body, your thoughts, and your feelings.
Are you saying that once I learn to accept myself and surrender to whatever happens, that life gets easier?
Life will continue to provide you with challenges and tests, she said. But as you relax into life, Even your difficulties will have a pleasurable aspect, like playing a challenging game or solving a puzzle. I can't shake the feeling that all this is much easier said than done. Everything is easier said than done, she replied. So begin in little ways. When you have a minor disagreement, acknowledge the other person's point of view and see what happens. Shrug off small disappointments. Follow the guidance of Epictetus, the Greek sage who advised his students, learn to wish that everything should come to pass exactly as it does. You know, of all the laws I've learned, this seems the most challenging, I said. It feels like I have to give up a part of myself, my desires, values, and preferences. The sage's face shone with its own light as she answered. The law of surrender honors the sanctity of each soul with its divine spark of individuality. You need not give that up, traveler. You need only get out of your own way. Surrendering your smaller will to a higher will is not a common practice, she continued, because you'd rather do what you prefer. This is understandable. But life doesn't always give us what we prefer, so our desires lead to attachment, anxiety, and frustration. Following your small will may lead to temporary satisfaction, but not to lasting happiness. When you see clearly that life is not only about getting what you want, but also about learning to want what you get, you'll align your life with the law of surrender. How do I actually practice this law? I asked. Begin by asking in any situation, what is for the highest good of all concerned? This might mean praying for rain in your drought-stricken area, even though your own roof is leaking. True surrender can be expressed in the heartfelt wish, not my will, but thy will be done. That's going to be a stretch for me. A big stretch for anyone, she said, smiling. But stretching is a part of life. It begins by shifting your energy and attention from the desires of a smaller will to the wisdom of a higher will. Are you talking about the will of God? Offering the prayer, Thy will be done, does not require that you believe in an external God, only that you speak from your heart and ask yourself, if a wise, loving, compassionate God were guiding me now, what would I do in this situation? Then feel your heart and listen to your higher self. You will know what to do, and you'll find the courage and love to do it. Because Spirit does indeed work through you, whether or not you are fully aware of it. I'm not sure how to begin, I confessed. Just open to life at whatever level you can. Over time, the practice of surrender becomes deeper and more profound, until you can embrace the rain clouds as you would the pleasures of a sunny day. And remember to relax. Relaxation is the body's way of surrendering to the moment, letting go of fixed ideas about what should happen, so that you can respond freshly and innocently to each moment, without judgment or expectation. Just then, we looked up to see the cat who had taught me about presence sitting above us on a nearby boulder. Her Majesty is holding court, I said. The sage, of course, saw this as another object lesson. Have you noticed, traveler, how cats will persist in going where they want to? Yes, I've noticed, I said, gazing up at the cat. But if someone is blocking their way, she added, they sit back, relax, let go, and take the opportunity to lick their paws. Few people have learned the art of surrender as well as cats and masters of the martial arts. What does surrender have to do with the martial arts? The highest martial arts, like water, are flowing and flexible, responsive rather than rigid or reactive. Such arts teach us to pull when pushed, and to push when pulled, to blend with life's forces rather than wasting energy struggling against them. She stopped speaking and gazed up into the hills for a few moments, then turned back to me. Long ago, in feudal Japan, I was a young samurai seeking mastery of the sword. I trained many hours a day, practicing cuts, parries, and evasive movements. I found a master who consented to instruct me, but he would say nothing about my technique, insisting that it was secondary. Instead, he emphasized the importance of relinquishing any attachment to victory, safety, or desired outcomes. Only the warrior who could let go of the smaller self with its desires, fears, and attachments would remain relaxed and focused. In a duel, surrendering to death meant survival. Clinging to life meant losing it. Do you understand? This law has life and death practicality. The more you let go of attachments, the more you expand into greater freedom. Anticipating my next question, the sage added, surrendering attachments doesn't mean giving away one's house or earthly goods. It's an internal act, a willingness to embrace whatever happens. Well, when exactly does the law apply in everyday life? The sage laughed. When does it not apply? Pick any circumstance you might normally reject, avoid, or resist. Then surrender to it completely. Turn it your way and make the best of it. Surrender to your highest impulses as you work for positive change in the world. But, like the cat, don't waste energy resisting or fretting over circumstances you can't control. We stopped to survey the rolling hills below. The sage sat down on the grassy hillside and I followed suit. Then, quietly, almost reverently, she continued, I acknowledge how difficult it is to surrender to life as it appears, to the greed, pain, and injustice in the world. In time, however, you will come to see everyone and everything as an aspect of spirit, accepting on faith that despite our difficulties, everything in the universe is unfolding as it must. Surrender is an act of humility, an acknowledgement that life is a mystery whose depth the mind cannot fathom. As Isaac Bashev the Singer wrote, life is God's novel, let God write it. I can promise you this, traveler, she concluded. The law of surrender will show the way to a natural state of grace, opening the way for a flowering of faith, leading to the realization of your essential unity with all beings, an awareness so profound that it accelerates your evolution and catapults you on the path of human potential into a spiritual reality existing long before the material world. Clouds blew in from the coast, bringing a quick shower and a rainbow to the northeast. As we paused at a scenic overlook, the sage spoke of the final law she was to share with me before our parting. The law of unity, she began, presents a special challenge for both of us, because its transcendent nature makes it fully understandable only from a higher state of awareness. So, at first, I may touch only your mind, but my words are seeds. When they sprout forth and touch your heart, this law can transform your life forever. The law of unity calls forth the great realization that we are not as separate as we appear to be, that we are actually one being, one consciousness. No disrespect intended, I said, but so what? I mean, what does this law have to do with everyday life? This will become clear soon enough, she replied. The law of unity isn't easy for the small self to grasp because it doesn't coincide with everyday perception. So let's first acknowledge that at the level of everyday reality, we do indeed have separate bodies, minds, and emotions. If I have a thought, it doesn't necessarily arise in your head at the same time. If I experience an emotion, you may not feel the same way. If I bruise my shin, you don't feel the pain. The law of unity is a paradox, you see, both false and true, depending upon our state of awareness. Whether we are one or many depends more upon our perspective than on any objective reality. Conventional knowledge tells us that we are separate. Higher wisdom informs us that we are one. A shift of perception reveals that we are all the same consciousness, manifesting in different bodies, the way leaves are a part of the same tree. Humanity forgets to notice this higher truth, however, focusing instead on our differences, on our separation. But you won't forget, will you, traveler? I won't forget, I said, but I'm not sure I fully understand it either. At least we've taken a first step. Let's see where the next one leads, she said, picking up an acorn from the forest floor. If we examine this acorn, we call it one. Yet it's made up of millions of different cells, molecules, and atoms. We call a tiny atom one, but it's also composed of many particles and forces. If we examine our planet, we call it one. Yet it's actually made of earth, air, fire, and water, including thousands of species, billions of living beings, and countless trillions of atoms. So, is an acorn, an atom, or the earth, one, or many? And what of humanity?
I had no answer. I could only ponder the question. I guess it's a paradox, I finally said.
Yes, agreed the sage. And since that is so, you can choose how you will view reality from a smaller or larger state of perception.
Let's look at it another way, she continued. Do you agree, traveler, that language reflects our most fundamental perceptions? That the way we speak and the words we use have something to do with how we view our reality?
Yes, that sounds right.
So when you say the words, I'm going to my house, that sentence makes sense, doesn't it?
Sure.
And the you who refers to it as my house is, of course, separate from the house, correct?
Yeah, I'm with you so far.
Well then, what do you mean when you say, my body feels good today? The you who refers to it as my body, is that you also separate from the body?
Well, I never thought about it before. I guess it's just a convention of speech, I answered.
Yes, it is, she continued. But you agree that language reflects our fundamental view of reality. And this sentence clearly implies that you are not your body, but something that has a body.
Well, yes, I guess it does.
Is it possible that our language reveals a deeper truth? Let's take it a step further. If you are not your body, who are you?
Well, I guess you could say I'm a soul or a higher self that has a body or lives in a body, something like that.
All right, then. But what does it mean if you refer to my soul or my higher self? Who is this me?
I don't know.
Could it be that the you who speaks through the body, who refers to my house, my body, my soul, my higher self, is, in the truest sense, pure awareness itself?
I don't know. It's a paradox.
Yes, it is indeed. Consider it, traveler. The awareness that looks out through a billion eyes is the one consciousness of infinite love and wisdom that we call God, who watches life unfold with mercy and compassion, and who is life itself. Could it be that even as you go about your daily business, with your personal desires and concerns and dreams, that you are that awareness which also manifests as all these bodies and minds and trees and birds and acorns?
May I be excused, I said. My brain is full.
She laughed. That's just the problem. Your brain cannot figure it out. You can only feel it or not. When you do, in rare and expanded moments, your mind will finally come to rest. You'll bathe in absolute bliss and experience pure peace and joy. Until then, these are only words.
I sighed, feeling as if I were missing something important. I wanted to experience what she was saying.
Again, responding to my innermost thoughts, the sage lifted my chin and looked into my eyes. I gazed back and found myself drawn in deeper and deeper, until her face began to change. First I saw light around her. Then she was a very old woman, and then a fierce warrior, and then other people too, until finally I saw myself. I don't mean my reflection. I mean that our connection was so deep that only one being was there, not two. Then I snapped back into everyday awareness. We were sitting cross-legged in the soft grass. I was dazed and speechless.
That was only a preview, traveler, said the sage. I'm not asking you in your everyday awareness to experience or believe or fully understand your oneness with all of creation. That experience is only given by grace. But when you've felt that oneness with even one human being, you can know it with the world. A part of you, a deep place within your heart, knows this higher truth. That is why you can, in any moment, align yourself with the law of unity, by choosing to perceive other people, loved ones, friends, and adversaries alike, as aspects of your larger self. So the next time you argue with someone, she continued, or make love, or play a sport, ask yourself, what if I chose to see others as an aspect of me? Chose to perceive us as one. How would I act? How might that influence my relationships? What then would happen to feelings of envy or jealousy? What would happen when my smaller self-interest became a much larger interest in the good of the whole? would not competition become cooperation as you realize that even your adversaries were your students and teachers, a part of you?
It seems like it would change almost everything, I said.
This realization can indeed change the world, one soul at a time, said the sage.
A number of teachers and books refer to this idea of unity, but few have truly heard, the sage responded. The world is only now growing ripe, nearly ready to understand, not just a few idealists, but a multitude of realists who recognize that human evolution, even human existence, depends upon this expanded vision of
as one. Just as our different organs cooperate for the good of the entire body, our world is on the cusp of a shift from competitive self-interest to open-hearted cooperation in the interest of the whole body of humanity. In that moment, I understood why she had first greeted me as a long-lost brother. The sage actually saw me and everyone else as a part of her. "Can you understand," she said, speaking to my thoughts, "why life seems so humorous to me? Talking to you, looking at a tree, watching the deer, I see only another aspect of myself. I pick berries and it's like that J.D. Salinger story," I interrupted. "A boy drinks some milk and feels like he's pouring God into God."
"Yes, traveler, it's just like that.
And as you begin to see friends and adversaries, loved ones and strangers, through the eyes of the one being, then all dilemma and conflict are dissolved. All wounds are healed, and all paradoxes resolved in the light of this essential truth. This is the end of all seeking, because you are everyone and everywhere. It is the end of all fear, because you grasp as living truth who you are, that pure awareness which never dies. In unity is the completion of all the laws of spirit, a state of balance and equanimity, perfect faith in the choices you make and the process of your life, patience as you walk step by step in the eternal present, compassion for all other aspects of your larger self. Here, doubts are overcome and all actions shine with integrity. After lifetimes of searching, you are at one with the universe. The sage's voice grew softer, as if she were in a reverie.
"Can you grasp it, traveler? Can you feel the truth of my words? Do you understand that you are the burning child in a war-torn village, and you are the pilot dropping fire? That you are the mother and the newborn babe, the victim of a brutal assault and the rapist who commits the crime? All things done in the name of God or the devil you have done. The highest and most humble are you, wearing rags of torn cloth and robes of gold. You are in every act of kindness or cruelty, of cowardice or courage. Where goes the fool or the sage, and the creatures who walk or swim or fly, there go you. One and many, high and low, bitter and sweet. You are the earth, and above, and below. You are the light that shines through the eyes of all beings, truly one. That is how I know your thoughts and how I can speak of my past lives. Since we are one, we share all past lives and all futures, which are occurring now, since past, present, and future are also one.
Do you mean, I asked, that when I come to realize this unity as deeply as you, I'll also be able to tune into other people's thoughts and know past lives?
Of course, she said, laughing. You'll know anything you need to know in order to serve others. But such powers will no longer concern you because you will be everyone. Aligning your life with the law of unity changes everything, even while everything appears the same. You live an ordinary life as I do. You appear an ordinary person, yet the world becomes infinitely sweeter, more intense, beautiful, humorous, and peaceful. We emerged from a protective ring of trees and started down the mountain, back to where I'd find the familiar path home, for we were nearing the end of our time together. As we walked, the sage wove a new vision of our future. As a global consciousness awakens, traveler, we find ourselves in the midst of a fundamental transition.
This transition will not be without difficulties, but the Great Awakening is as inevitable as the last breath of the dying or a baby's first cry. As we speak, the illusion of separation is giving way to the higher truth of our unity. Now is the time to embrace the earth, for soon we will embrace the universe. As the sage finished speaking, we stepped onto a familiar trail, and I felt a sense of completion. "Does this mean my training is over?" I asked. "You've completed the first important steps, but the journey never ends," she answered. "What about the assistance you said you needed, the important mission?" "That, traveler, you and many other souls will come to understand in good time. The mission is happening right now, all part of the Great Awakening. And now I must go. There is a young woman in England I'm to meet soon, then a grandfather in Spain. A child in Germany awaits me, though she doesn't realize it, and there is an Iranian soldier now standing guard who calls silently to me. I feel the longing for which they have no words. And there are others too, traveler, waiting as you have waited." "How can I ever thank you?" I asked. "Live the laws," she said. "It is enough. I'll never forget you. When you remember the laws, you'll remember me." She placed her hands on my shoulders. Her eyes, filled with the light of compassion, looked deeply into my own. "Traveler, our time together has begun a graceful yet irreversible learning process. I have given you these laws not to bind you, but to free you. They come from deep within you. They are the alchemist's keys to love, freedom, joy, and fulfillment. They are the stepping stones to your human destiny and what lies beyond. You don't have to remember these laws. You only have to live them, and they will transform your life. They are seeds planted well and within you forever, waiting for the right time to sprout and grow. And they will, most assuredly, they will, for the gardener is always with you, providing whatever you need. These sprouts will blossom in their own good time, bearing fruits of courage and love and understanding. Nothing matches their power, and yet they are all secondary to the law of love. For if you lose touch with your heart's wisdom, nothing else avails. If you love, nothing else is necessary. These laws will free the love trapped within you to expand into the world in joyous service for the common good. These are my wishes and prayers for you all the days of your life. May you find grace as you surrender to life. May you find happiness as you stop seeking it. May you come to trust these laws and inherit the wisdom of the earth. May you reconnect with the heart of nature and feel the blessings of spirit. The challenges of daily life will remain, and you will tend to forget what I have shown you. But a deeper part of you will remember, and when you do, life's problems will seem no more substantial than soap bubbles. The path will open before you where before there grew only weeds of confusion. Your future, and the future of all humanity, is a path into the light, into a growing realization of the unity with the Creator and all creation. And what lies beyond is beyond description. Even when the sky appears at its darkest, know that the sun shines ever upon you, that love surrounds you, and that the pure light within you will guide your way home. So trust the process of your life unfolding, and know with certainty, through the peaks and valleys of your journey, that your soul rests safe and secure in the arms of Spirit. Be guided, as I have been guided, and know the peace of God. Having spoken her final words, the sage turned up the path and quickly disappeared. The sun was just breaking through the mist as I found my way down the hillside. I glanced back once, perhaps hoping to see the figure of a woman standing somewhere above, at the edge of the forest. But seeing only my own shadow cast by the setting sun, I turned once again toward home.